Blog Talk Radio.
Coming to Bard's Logic. We do have a very special guest tonight, and that is award-winning composer Julia Newman. And you have just heard a sample of some of the work that she has put out. I thought I was going to have on another one, but we can explain that later. So I'd like to thank everyone for coming in tonight, whether you were coming from Blog Talk Radio, and if so, and you are having a hard time calling in or coming to the chat, I apologize. It looks like that there is some difficulties with that, so I apologize. But one good thing is that these shows are archived for later listening and distribution. So I thank you there, and also thank you if you're coming through some of the other venues to listen to the show, including the Bard's Logic website. And so just check that out. And so that's it tonight. We have Julia Newman, which you've probably heard her some of her music on the television series Bones, in which she was honored with the ASCAP Film and Television Music Award for her work on the series. In addition, she also composed music for Fox's spinoff series, The Finder. And you could also have some of her work known for is the films Blood Diamond, Michael Clayton, I Am Legend, and The Happening, and much more. And you could just check out more of her works and what she's been involved in by going to www.julianewman.com, and she spells her last name N-E-W-M-A-N-N. And I do believe that we have Julia here on the line. So, Julia, I'm opening up your mic. Thank you very much for coming to the show. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me, and what a nice introduction. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you very much, and I'm glad we were able to get this going. It doesn't sound like you've had any of the difficulties I've in the studio about calling in, so that's great.
Nope, got on right away. There was no problems at all.
But, awesome.
Yeah, I wonder, is it weather-related or something that, you know, with the internet or...
I am not... Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I'm not certain. I don't have any weather things going on here. There just might be some technical difficulties because I do see that some folks may be having some problem with the chat aspect. We're not sure.
Gotcha.
But I know there's we do get some folks who come in who like to chat during the shows. But if that capability is not out there for you folks, I do apologize. It's quite a shame because I know a lot of you have been waiting for tonight for a while. So, but there's always the archives, of course. If they miss it tonight, they also can listen to it there. It's one of the great things is that these are recorded and archived for later viewing. Or not
totally.
Viewing, listening. Listening type viewing, that'd be great. And speaking Speaking of viewing, we could just run right into it. And part of the introduction was about your work on the television series Bones. And so we'll like to start off with that and tell us more about it.
Well, I've been lucky enough to work on Bones for, this is now my fifth season, and this is the first TV series that I've worked on, and I just feel so incredibly grateful that I got to work on a hit TV show. At this point in my career, it was a big jump for me, and we're actually headed into 100 episodes together soon, so it's really quite remarkable. Just got renewed for a ninth season, we just found out last week, so I just feel very lucky. But it all started back in probably 2003 when I graduated from USC. I was looking for composers to assist or write music for or really do anything just to, they really say that it's great to work for a composer at the start of your career to observe how they do it. You learn a lot from what they do, and they, especially if they give you writing opportunities, it really helps you get to the next step sooner. And so my demo was passed off to Sean Callery somehow. I had been giving out my demo to various people since I had graduated, and I went through the ASCAP film scoring workshop, which is a very difficult workshop to get into, and it's really quite special because they allow you to record your music with a professional Hollywood studio orchestra, and they give you a scene to rescore from a major movie, and they teach you all about the business, so you make lots of contacts there. And so I thought, you know, if I passed my demo around to people in that workshop that were running it and so forth, that could be a good thing. And weeks later, I get this really nice message from a composer named Sean Callery, who I, of course, heard of because he was doing 24 at the time. And he said
that... I love that show, by the way.
I know. It's
that was
awesome.
One of my favorite shows. Edge of your seat show. But go ahead. I didn't want to interrupt, but I love that show.
Oh, I know. It's freaking awesome. And so my husband, well, boyfriend at the time, and I were way into that show, and we were loving the score. His music to that was just so intense and interesting and detailed, and so much more going on with that music than other TV scores I was hearing at the time. And he just really stood out to me and someone I really admired already. And here I'm coming back from just a temp job. I was fresh out of school, just still trying to get my feet on the ground, and I was just going to various temp jobs to help pay the bills while I was looking for something better. And he leaves me this message saying that he received my demo and was very impressed with it and would love to talk with me further and work with me at some point. And I was just honored, and I called him right back, and we clicked right away. And it did take a while, though. It took a while to find... for him to find or get the right opportunity to invite me on. And I stayed in touch with him for about 4 years. And meanwhile, I was working for James Newton Howard, and I was doing my own stuff, and I just kept him in the loop. And then I was no longer working for James, and I was redoing my website to look for the next thing. And I asked Sean if he could write me a testimonial for my website, and he said, of course, send me your most latest music. I'd love to, you know, rehear what you've been doing and you know, learn more about what you're doing currently. And he was very impressed with my current work. He said he heard a lot of growth in it, and he heard some things in it that got him very excited, because he just auditioned for Bones, and he was looking for someone to help with the composing on it, and he thought I would be a good fit and was asking me if I was interested in working in TV because I was coming from film. And I thought, sure, why not? I mean, that would be very exciting, and working on a hit TV show is so wonderful because you know you'll be hopefully guaranteed 9 months of work if the show does well and then it keeps going with the residuals and so forth. And so he gave me three scenes to score kind of as a test to see how I would do it. And he gave me a week to do it, three very different kinds of scenes. One was more romantic, another one was more of an action scene, and the third one was like a courtroom scene. So he could see my range and my sensitivity and so forth. So I worked really hard on those. I sent them to him, and he thought that I was a good fit, and he said, you know, this is, I know you've never worked in TV before, but I just have this instinct about you, and I feel like this could be, you're ready for this. And I'm actually kind of glad that I had a few years before to get more experience in other things and the other projects I worked on, working for James. I've learned a lot of stuff to be ready for this kind of job. And so now 5 seasons later, 100 episodes later, that's what I've been doing. And it's a really fun show to work on because it has a big range from mystery to there's a big romance part of it between Booth and Brennan. And I love doing those scenes. And then there's also horror because almost every show starts with a body reveal. And you'll have unknown characters that start the show that are just maybe walking through the forest, la-di-da-di-da, and then they step on something really gross and they look down and scream and see a corpse. And then that will be what the forensic anthropologists will be dissecting and analyzing and figuring out who killed this person. So I tend to do those scenes, which were really fun because I could use all sorts of weird sounds and mm-hmm. create lots of suspense. And so it keeps you on your toes. It keeps, it's nice that it's a very multifaceted show. And I've met people that are 10 years old that enjoy it up to senior citizens. So it's really cool in that sense too. So that's the story of Bones.
that's pretty awesome. It's been around for a little while. A little while for it. You've been doing it, you said, for 5 years, but it was running some years before that as well, correct?
It was, yeah. It was running for 4 seasons before that. They fired the first composer. They wanted a different kind of sound. The show was kind of progressing in a different direction, and they mm-hmm. they wanted someone actually that had a little bit more of a film sound to it. And mm-hmm. Sean definitely has that coming from 24. And then I had that background from my experience. And it's been a dream to work on that show. They like what we were doing and it gives it kind of a new feeling. And, we had no idea it would go this long, and we're just counting our blessings. So, yeah.
Well, and you mentioned, and I'm not very versed on this, I must admit. We talk about scoring. What's all involved when you're scoring, somebody for a show, or a scene, or something of that nature?
Sure. Yeah. Well, generally, with TV, this goes with film too, but. They'll give you a cut of the film or show, and we like as composers to have it as locked as possible so that when they're making film edits, it's such a linear thing that if they start to change the length of scenes and stuff, then we have to change what we did in the music to make sure it's still lining up correctly. They'll give us a cut, and it will have temporary music in it. And that will give us a guide as to what kind of styles they're looking for. And they'll also give us what's called spotting notes. Usually the lead composer or team, whatever, will go in and go over with the director, or in this case in TV, usually the producers act as more of the creative people in post-production. They'll go over where they would like music and what kind, and the start time, the end time. And so it just gives you a nice guide as to into what they're looking for, because there's so many different ways to interpret a scene. With bones, we generally get 5 to 6 days, and that's pretty quick time frame, but pretty standard in TV, and we have a pretty high minute count these days, so that's why there are three of us on the show. Sean is the lead composer, and he will divide up the scenes, and he'll give me a chunk, and he'll give his other guy a chunk and himself, and I'll just do the scenes that I'm assigned to, and I watch it through first, the whole show, like an audience member, to just get a feel for what the show is about. And then I listen to the temporary music first, and then I get a sense of that, I mute that, and then I start putting in the different sounds. I'll start with maybe a string line or something, and then I'll add some atmospheric sounds under that, or some catching here. It all depends on what it is, but these days, especially in TV, it's all synthesized. We've never really hired musicians for this because it's too quick of a turnaround, but the sounds these days are very convincing, and you can really do a very good job in making it sound real. And that's pretty much the process. If in the film world, it's a little slower because in the TV world, what we do is we deliver the music in different sections. Like, let's say in a scene, I have strings, brass, some woodwinds and bass or something. Well, I can't send them a stereo mix of all of the music together. I do send that as a reference, but they want to have all the different sections of the music divided up so that they can work with the levels and maybe mute something that is too busy, or this particular instrument is too loud, so they want to bring that down because it's interfering with the dialogue. Or a lot of the times we're working to a rough cut because they're still tweaking the final edit, and so the music editor will kind of work with our music after we've finished and re-edit some things to the final picture so we don't have to do it. So that's kind of a luxury. In the film world, it's a little slower, and there's a little more back and forth in which the director will come over, he'll see a chunk of scenes, give you his notes, and you'll make tweaks and send it back. And then if you're lucky enough to have a real orchestra, then after he's heard all the mock-ups, or he or she, then you would record it all with a real orchestra, and then you would have that whole phase of it.
Keep going. It's a very interesting subject, and I want to interrupt you, so if there's more, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was just going to say, when I was working for James Newton Howard, I got to really see what he goes through with these major films and these major directors, and I went with him to London when he was recording the music for The Water Horse. I got to orchestrate for him, and the way that works is nowadays a composer will do their mock-ups, but they're not really ready to be played by an orchestra because we're playing in, like, the brass, let's say, with a keyboard instrument, and so we're playing it in as like a chord instead of it being split out into each player's part. So the orchestrator has to kind of arrange the mock-up for the orchestra, and then the orchestrator will expand it and do little things to make it sound fuller and so forth. So that's some of what I did for him. And there's just a lot of involved in that process. You have to get a recording engineer to record it. You have to have a mixer to mix the music for you. And, that process alone, after you've done the score, usually is about like a week or something. But usually, nowadays, the mock-ups need to be pretty close to the they need to sound pretty close to the final orchestra version, because directors and producers really want to hear what they're getting, not like the old days where they would hear your mock up on a piano, let's say, and you have to imagine it. So there's benefits to that, and they tend to be people aren't using their imaginations anymore and not trusting the process as much. They need to hear everything the way it's going to be before they hear it live. It gets us to write a little differently too, because these sampled instruments do have their limitations, and you have to write in a way that makes them sound good. And so you end up having to simplify a little bit. And so now there's been this progression with film scores. Like back in the 90s, they were much more flashy, and the music stood on its own a lot more. And the last 10 years or so, music has gotten to be a lot simpler and more textural, and you're hearing a lot more of a hybrid between electronic and some live instruments opposed to full orchestras, and the budgets are shrinking. So it's kind of a double-edged sword with all this technology we have now. I could go on and on about that.
Let's see. Well, it's definitely something that sounds like you're very passionate about, and you definitely have your ideas on how, you know, you think it should be done to make it more authentic. But one thing while I was looking at all the works is it has a title of being part of the music department. Now, music's not my stronghold, as people's probably strong points. People, would know. What's all entailed in the responsibilities of someone who's on the music department?
Well, it all depends. There's so many different things that can fall under that quarter category. It can be orchestrating, just basically painting the music with different instruments, then there's music editing. There's a music copyist, which is somebody that prepares the music for the musicians. They notate it all, and they make the music look all pretty and readable for the musicians. You can be a conductor.
Wow.
You can be a music assistant, or you can be writing additional music, which can mean a lot of different things. That could be a couple minutes to many, many scenes in a movie or a TV series. It basically is just all the other parts of music creation that can fall under that category.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because I know that you were on many music departments and a lot of the things that you've worked on.
Yeah,
and so
yeah.
That's why
it's a good question, yeah. And those are the good building blocks, in developing your career as a composer, is being able to do all of those different kinds of things, because you need to know how to do those things for what you're doing.
Okay. Well, what began your interest in composing music? Where and when did you get started?
Well, I was about 8 years old, I believe, and I was at my grandma's, and she had a piano, and nobody else in my family was a musician, so I kind of found it fascinating, and her piano was special. It was kind of like a magical piano, because it was one of those ones that when you put a roll of sheet music in, it would play by itself. I forget there's a specific term, but they used to make them...
Oh, wow, yeah, I've seen one of those. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so when you're a little kid looking at that, it's just like, wow, it was really cool, and that really inspired me, and then I wanted to start playing it and see what I could do, and I didn't know anything, but I just started experimenting with the sounds, and I came up with little melodies, and then I started adding my left hand, which was really exciting back then, and then I was able to add harmonies and another part, and I just started developing naturally, and then my grandmother had all these music boxes, and she played them to me, and I would listen to one, and then I would run to the piano and play it back verbatim, she said. So she's the one that discovered it and said I had a musical ear, and she told my parents, and they were very supportive because they would always play classical music, all sorts of music in the house when I was growing up. And my dad said that I would be waving my arms when I was a baby to Beethoven. So
oh,
I think
wow.
It was kind of happening pretty early on. And they wanted to support this. They're big music appreciators. So, so my mom eventually got me lessons after several years of me kind of creating these compositions all by ear and remembering them and playing other stuff by ear. And then she's like, "Don't you want to learn how to write them down at some point?" I said, "Yeah, that would be a good thing to know." And so I kind of did things backwards, and I my technique was pretty far along because I was self-taught, and I didn't know how to read music until I was 11. So that's when my teacher taught me the basics, back to the basics of what a whole note is, a quarter note, all those things. And then eventually she taught me how to write my music down, and I was performing, I was practicing 4 hours a day to get my technique
wow.
better, so that, and it was really more an effort to for my composing, all of that education. I knew then that I really wanted to do this, and I didn't know what I wanted to do with my music yet. When I was 13, I went to see the movie Legends of the Fall, and I was very struck by the film score in that, and it was so beautiful and moved me to tears. The story was such an emotional story, and the imagery and everything. I just had this epiphany then that, oh, I could write music for film. And I forgot to mention that leading up to that, I used to write music surrounding my paintings. I would tell little stories with the music, and so I already had like this whole visual thing going on, and I wasn't sure whether I wanted to be an artist or a composer for a living, but I thought, how cool would it be if I found something that could combine the two? And scoring seemed to be the thing to do, and so I told my parents when I was 13 I want to be a film composer, and I just felt it to the core. And I was very emotional and passionate about it. And my parents were a little worried at first because it's not an easy field to break into, especially as a woman. It's a very male-dominating field. And but I don't know why that is, but that's just how it was. And they backed me up, and they believed in me, and I switched high schools. I switched to a music magnet high school to get better education, it was a very competitive degree to get. I wanted to go to USC film scoring program, and they only allowed like 8 people in per year, and I got in, and that was such a validation for me that other people thought that I could do this. And so I went to USC, I got my music composition degree and did the film scoring program my last year, and got so much hands-on experience, because in that program, they also will let you record with professional studio musicians. Every couple weeks you would get to rescore a scene from a big movie, and you would get to conduct it, you would produce it, it was as if you were scoring the real film, and it would be such a good lesson to hear back what you wrote and how you can improve. You can make mistakes there and learn from them, and the musicians were just so kind and supportive, so it was just a great start.
Awesome. Yeah, it's always great to have parents who, are very supportive, what the kids want to do. And actually, it looks like some folks were able to break through and get into the chat. And
cool.
is Diane, thank you very much for your answer. We were talking about the piano that I didn't know the name of this either. It's at the back of my head. But thank you, Diane. It was called just a player piano.
I thought it was a player piano, but I didn't want to say it wrong. So.
I understand. I do that, too. Yeah, I'm like, yeah, exactly. I don't want to be wrong with, you know, if that's an it. But thank you very much, Diane, for letting us know
yes,
that or reminding
you.
Us of the name of that. So, you know, what I've got here is... doing a little research, and you know, as you know, from you, know, you were on another show that I did when I had the folks from the David Children Wildlife Trust on, and I'd like to ask you a little bit about that later on in a bit. But first, I'd like to start off as one of the things I found is in 2001, you wrote a choral piece called "Where Once the Waters of Your Face." And you won an award for the National Composers Guild Composition Contest, and that's while you were attending the University of Southern California. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, at the time, I was in the USC choir, and I didn't realize I enjoyed singing in choir so much, and I just loved the sound and all these voices uniting as like this one musical organism. And I thought, how, you know, this would be a new frontier for me. And one of the professors there, Morten Lauritsen, who's a famous choral composer, he's probably one of the most performed choral composers of our time. And his music was so beautiful and inspired me so much that I just wanted to give it a shot. And I thought it would be a cool new way to compose, and I sung myself, as I said. So I remember sitting at the piano singing while I was, you know, writing out the different parts. And I was reading a book of poems at the time that gave me various inspirations by Dylan Thomas, and he wrote this poem, "Where Once the Waters of Your Face," and it had just beautiful, haunting imagery. And as I read through, I realized it was about a miscarriage, it sounds like, about saying goodbye to the life that was never really living. And it was just very haunting to me. And it's not that I ever went through that myself, but it was just so emotional. And I thought it could be something that I could do with voices. And I had this whole flute section I should maybe read a few lines from it.
I'd love to hear that. Mm-hmm.
It's "Where once the waters of your face spun to my screws, your dry ghost blows, the dead turns up its eye. Where once the mermen threw your ice, pushed up their hair, the dry wind steers through salt and root and roe. Where once your green knots sank their splice into the tided cord, there goes the green unraveler, his scissors oiled, his knife hung loose to cut the channels at their source and lay the wet roots low. Invisible, your clocking tides breaks on the love beds of weeds, the weed of love's left dry. The round about your stones of shades of children go, who from their voids cry to the dolphin sea. Dry as a tomb, your colored lids shall not be latched while magic glides. Sage on the earth and sky, there shall be corals in your beds. There shall be serpents in your tides till all our sea fates die." So I just saw the imagery that he used. I thought was just so powerful and interesting. And then I thought to myself, like, it could be interpreted different ways. I thought, well, maybe it could be actually maybe an abortion. When I was reading the green unraveler, his scissors oiled, his knife hung loose. And so I did this whole section after the haunting voices came in and stuff. I used the flute to do this sort of violent sounding solo. And that was symbolizing the green unraveler. And then the voices come back sort of fighting with the flute. And they had this kind of back and forth thing going on. And then as it gets further along into it, it kind of develops into more of a bittersweet kind of sound, looking back at the life that never was there. And I don't know, it just really hit me for whatever reason. And so it was one of my favorite pieces that I wrote, and just working with the singers was really fun. And I sang in it myself. And then I thought, maybe I'll send it to a composition contest and see how it does. And then it won second place. So I was, like, thrilled.
Wow, yeah. Yeah, but where can someone find that? Because I know, and personally for myself, because, you know, there was an event, you know, like you said about a miscarriage. I know that happened with my first child, so I'd definitely be interested. Yeah, so that'll definitely be a personal thing for myself. Where could someone find, find to listen to that?
You know what? I had it on my website, and I no longer have it on my website because it's more geared towards film music and TV music. But I can certainly send you the link.
Oh, that'd be phenomenal! Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, sure. I haven't written that. That was actually my one and only choir piece so far, so it's pretty special to me. But thank you for your interest.
Well, no, definitely. As I said, a personal note there with myself.
Sure.
Of course, there's other folks out there, you know, who's been in the same situation. But I do agree with what your point about, there are some parts that sounds, more like an abortion than a miscarriage. So I would definitely want to read that as well, read the poem as well. I used to really be into poetry back in my early 20s. Not that I'm trying to show my age, but...
I used to be more into poetry myself. It's certainly to put music in poetry. It's a good inspiration.
Well, I was a big, well, I still am, a big Jim Morrison fan myself. And, he wrote poetry. He's actually had, three things of poetry published out. So he had some interesting stuff out there, or has some interesting stuff out there. Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty good. Back in my early to mid-20s, I don't read as much poetry as I used to. And I used to actually write some prose and poetry back in the day. But I digress. This isn't about what I did back when I was younger. So we'll move on to another interesting piece that the folks can see is that in 2005, you mentioned earlier you did some interns and mentioned James Newton Howard. And in 2005, and I think I've even seen this movie, but it's The King Kong. And tell us your involvement and how you became the intern for Mr. Howard and how, how it was working on that movie.
Yeah, well, I actually came in at the tail end process. I was looking for a job for a composer, and I phoned the chairman of the USC film scoring program that I was in, and I said, do you know any composers that are looking for some extra help? I'll do anything. And he said, well, you happen to call at a very lucky time because James Newton Howard needs an extra hand on King Kong. And I was like, wow. And he said, it might just be a temporary thing. It might be just on for this project, but, you never know what it can turn into. And I interviewed with his assistant, and he was recording over at Fox. So he needed somebody to interview for him, and I got the job and started that day. And it was really actually not that glamorous. I mean, I was working in the composer's studio the whole time, and I got to go to a few of the recording sessions to see his music to the film. And I got to sit in on a meeting with him and the big director that did King Kong and Lord of the Rings and all of that, Peter Jackson. So what was interesting is Peter Jackson was in New Zealand and James was in L.A. and they did this meeting over the satellite. And back then in 2005, that was kind of a big deal. I don't think we had Skype really. It's at least as much as we do now. And so I got to sit in on a meeting of his and witness how he would get notes from the director and how he would dress them and so forth. But really when I started there, I was doing errands, I was getting coffee, I was organizing his music for the next session. I was helping his assistants mainly with just various grunt work, and I just came with a really good attitude, and I was very interested in everything that I was seeing. It was really I was there to help out, but I also, what was cool about it is you just kind of soak up everything that you're surrounded by, and just all the politics that go on and
everything. Oh, my gosh, yeah, I could tell you about some of that.
Oh, I'm sure. So anyway, so I was there for 10 days, and after that, I said, after King Kong ended, I asked James, I said, you know, if you need more help on your next films, I'm available, like anything I can do. And he said, well, actually, let me talk to the team. You know, you did a great job. You were very helpful to us. And you know, I'll get back to you. And so a week later, he calls and he hires me on as a full-time, assistant. And I ended up being there for 3 years, and I got to orchestrate for him on three big movies, Michael Clayton, The Great Debaters, and The War Horse. And I got to go with him to London to score one of the films, which was very interesting. And just various things that go on in a composer's studio that he needs help with, you know, it's just the wide range of things. And at a certain point, I just wanted to really get into my own writing more, and he just didn't need that kind of help. So I moved on and got hired on Bones, and here I am.
Well, back in 2006, shortly after that, I found that you worked on a DVD game, the $100,000 Pyramid. For a video game. Now, is that the only video game you worked on, or is that just something you want to dabble in, or would you like to do something more with that genre?
I would like to do some more with that. It was kind of a dabble in. At the time, I was doing indie features and documentaries and short films and stuff like that. A friend of mine from college actually was working for MGA Entertainment, and they were the ones responsible for the Bratz Babies and some other big games and stuff. And so he hired me to do music for this game, and I know it was after a famous game show with forgot his name.
Chuck Rowley or something, or was that the guy's name?
It wasn't really in my generation. I hate to say it, but
we may be in the same generation, maybe not. I don't know. But I'm not that much older than I think what you are.
have you heard of the $100,000 Pyramid?
Oh yes, and I've watched the TV show. So.
Oh, okay, cool.
When it was actually out, and not the reruns, when it first came out. I was young.
Well, anyway, so they were doing like a new spin on it, and and what's interesting about video games, at least in my experience and from what I've heard, is you're not really you get little samples of what the video game is going to look like, and they'll do a lot of talking about what it's about and the kinds of things that are going on in it, but then they'll say, we need 30 seconds of this kind of music, we need it to change to something, you know, like fast and exciting 30 seconds in, or, you know, they'll describe it, and you have to really visualize what's going on in the game, because they're still developing and doing all of the work on the game while you're writing the music. So it's in a way, it's not as fun, because you're not looking at the game as you're scoring it. It's more like you're imagining it. And then they will put it in later. But some video games get very serious with their music. I know that they have big budgets. They'll record live orchestras. And I know my friend Aubrey, who has been on the show, sang on some games. Mm-hmm. So there's really
Dragon
a,
Age.
Yeah. So there's
I love that
really...
game. I still play it.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. Yeah, so, you know, on Friday nights after I do shows, I try to stay up till like 5 in the morning playing. I don't get to play. I used to love to play video games.
Oh, no. Yeah, they're so addictive.
And especially the role-playing ones like Dragon Age. And, I still play it. I still like the game. I don't get the chance to play as much as I'd like to. But yeah, I mean, the music is phenomenal, you know. And you mentioned, you know, Aubrey came on the show.
Right.
And that was really cool. And, you know, because, I enjoyed her music as well. You know, so that was really nice. But actually, someone in the chat just told us that it was Dick Clark who was doing the
$100,000
pyramid. Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. That's right.
So,
may he rest in peace. Yes.
Yes. Yes. That's. Yeah.
But to answer your question, yes,
career,
I would
though.
Like to
Go
do
ahead.
More. Oh, totally. Yes. But so, yeah, as I was working for these other people, you know, I it was important to me to continue making relationships with other directors and doing my own projects and gaining
mm-hmm.
experience that way, too. So that was something that I did while I was working for James.
Now, is there any specific genre which you prefer, any part of the musical field that you find most fulfilling, whether it's composing, scoring, or orchestral music, things of that nature that, which one you prefer doing, what's your favorite?
Well, definitely composing is it's the way I express myself. It's the way I react to the world. It's just that is what I do, and it's the most fulfilling to me. And it's interesting because as I get older and I go through life more and experience more things, good or bad, it's kind of they all become reference points for me because I can draw on those experiences musically. And when certain things happen in Bones that I can relate to, it really helps my process because I could really key into the emotions of what is going on there. And I think that my favorite kind of music to write is probably emotional music that really makes people feel something and pulls on their heartstrings. And I it's a way to connect with people that is very special, I think. And, when I see other people reacting to what I did, it's hard to describe that kind of feeling. So, I mean, I enjoy doing other sorts of styles too, comedy and horror and action music. I mean, it depends on my mood too sometimes if I'm in mm-hmm. a more playful mood or whatever. But yeah, I think just to express something on a deeper level, I think is the most fulfilling for me.
Okay. Well, and then out of all the, if people can... check out your resume or, check out your website. We'll touch on that briefly. I mean, in a brief amount of time here is, which of the films or games or, orchestra music that you've done, documentaries, which actually I do see a documentary here I'd like to ask about while I'm talking about, is by Cody Westheimer, Running for My Father. I picked it up the other day. Unfortunately, I've not had. Yes, I did. I ordered it from Amazon, I must admit. Amazon.com.
Oh, cool.
unfortunately, I've not had the opportunity to watch it yet. I think it's like 30 minutes long, but I have not had the chance to watch it. It was actually on my agenda this week, but I'm sure you're well known, Joy. Sometimes those things get filled up. But I have it here. So if you since we're on that, if you could tell us a little bit about that, I'd really appreciate it. Give me a little background before I watch it.
Well, actually, that was a more of a joint venture. And actually, my husband is the one. He's also a composer. And he's the one that wrote the music for that. It's actually his personal story of when he lost his father and he started running to get over his grief and to move forward. And he ran his first marathon for his father. And it ended up being a very important step in the grieving process. And when he crossed that finish line, he was able to accept the loss more. He felt very empowered. And I was more there as in a supportive role. I filmed a lot of the footage and followed him on his training runs with his mom. We both were the filmmakers. And,
oh, okay. Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah, and I have an interview in it and so forth. But I've worked with my husband on a fair amount of projects as well. We've written together on various films, Freedom Park. There was also a documentary called Tapestries of Hope, which is a very sad story, but very important story to be told. And I mentioned this when I was on last time, that it's about the Zimbabwe children and how in Zimbabwe it is believed that if children are raped, they will be the people that rape the children will be cured of AIDS.
Right,
and so the filmmaker went out and exposed this, and she asked us to do it, and we did it as a labor of love to just help get the awareness out. And that was my first kind of film like that, and also my first African kind of score. And so we've worked together in a writing capacity. I've also orchestrated for him on his films that he's written the music for. There was one about Dean Karnassus, who ran 50 marathons in 50 states in 50 days.
Wow.
And he's pretty pretty famous among the endurance athletes. So I got to work on that. And, that sort of was a tangent, but...
No, that's okay. I know that's fine. That happens all the time here on Bard's Logic.
Yeah.
But we digress, or at least I know I do a lot. But, it's the organic nature of the show, which is fine. During my research that I do before interviews, I ran across it, and I thought, I'd like to watch that. I'd like to see that. So I picked it up, and I appreciate giving me, a little bit of background on it so that, when I'm watching it, I can say, oh, okay, yeah. Now I remember telling me about that.
Yeah, a lot of people find it very inspiring because, anyone who's lost someone that's special to them or can relate to it, and just finding ways to empower themselves to get over their grief and be able to move on and accept the situation. So it really changed him. He, ever since he ran that marathon, he now has done 2 Ironmans, 8 marathons. He's done like 4 triathlons, and it actually helped his career as a composer because now all the cycling he does, he met all these people that are in the film industry, and now he did the music for Tour de France and the...
cool.
It's opened up doors. So it's kind of interesting. You never know what in life will help your career.
True.
Yeah.
And earlier you mentioned, I see we're kind of winding down on the hour that you're able to get us, or you're able to give to us. So we'll try to wrap some things up. I mean, if you could stay longer, that'd be great. But if not, I understand because, that's how much you said you'd be able to a lot for us tonight. So I'll move things along. So I do have a couple more questions here in only about 7 minutes. As you mentioned earlier about in Africa. Now, recently you've been composing music for videos for the David Childrick Wildlife Trust. And if you could tell us how that's been going and what projects you have worked on thus far, and what plans are there for future works?
Yeah, well, that's been a very cool kind of side passion project that I've gotten involved with. And when I went to Africa, one of the first things my husband and I did was we visited the Sheldrick Wildlife Trust, and we met the baby elephant orphans, and we learned about why they were there and the poaching crisis and how these baby elephants are affected for the rest of their lives, and how the elephant population is just shrinking and shrinking every year. And when I was there, this one baby elephant jumped up on me and wrapped its little trunk around my arm and let me pet its tongue, and I had such a connection with them. I became an elephant lover that day, and I wanted to help them when I got back to the U.S. And I thought, instead of just fostering them, is there something bigger I can do that's more widespread? And I thought my husband actually had the idea to contact them and ask them if I could write music for them or donate, my music library of things that I've done over the years that could help them, because they produce these rescue videos. When they rescue a baby elephant, they'll often film the rescue and they will put it up online, and they will tell you the story of this baby elephant and the hopes that you will foster this elephant and support its journey into getting rehabilitated back into the wild and so forth. And so I asked them if they could use some, custom music for these videos, and they were very grateful, and they took me up on the offer. And the first one I did was a very emotional one, the rescue of Kwanzaa. And Kwanzaa was a baby elephant under a year old that was rescued back in October after her family got shot down and butchered for the ivory. And this baby elephant witnessed this butchering of her whole family for their ivory tusks. And it was actually a famous elephant family, the Embosile family, who has been studied since the 1960s, is what I found out. And the matriarch elephant, which was the mother of Kwanzaa, was in her 40s when she was killed. And people were just in shock that how awful this killing was, because the faces were just mutilated. They were just cut off. And it was just horrific imagery that they were showing. But they wanted to tell the whole story of what happened. And I believe that when you see terrible things like that, it does create change. And it makes people, it sits with you. And it makes you want to do something. And anyway, it started off as it was this whole montage where it started off with these beautiful photographs of this baby elephant with his family, and they were just photographed the day before they were poached. And then the next day they showed what happened, and they showed elephant corpses and the baby elephant being all by itself. And then they show the Sheldrick Trust flying out there to rescue the baby, and they bring the baby back, a traumatized baby, back to the orphanage, and they show the rehabilitation process and how the little baby gets comforted by all the other little elephants that had similar stories in the orphanage. And it's heartwarming at the end. But it really affected a lot of people. It ended up getting like 10,000 views, and it's just only growing. This was just, especially since this was such a famous elephant family, people were very interested in what happened. But it's just a representation of the many elephant families that get shot down. And so I did that, and then they were very grateful for what I did and how the music affected the imagery in the whole film. And they asked me to do another one, which was totally more uplifting and a different vibe. And it was actually the music that you played at the beginning of your show. And that was actually music for a field trip that the Sheldrick sponsors every month. A school will be chosen to come and visit the elephants in the stockades, and they will meet elephants for the very first time. And what I didn't know, being from the U.S., is that lots of children in Africa have not been exposed to wildlife. They, even though they're just, miles away from these national parks, they can't afford to go and see the animals, because you have to pay to go on a safari to enter these parks. And it's really only the people that live in the very rural areas that are exposed to the animals, and oftentimes they're looked at as a nuisance because they're getting into their farm crops, and the elephants are destroying their their homes or their gardens or their crops and so forth, they're not taught to appreciate the elephants and other wildlife. And so the Sheldrake Trust inspires these children at a young age to connect with these baby elephants, and you see them petting them and really enjoying them. And what I'm told from the ladies that were on this show, that they are just, these kids are just so smiley and so inspired and happy about these elephants that they made, and you hope that as they grow older, they'll have that as a reference point.
I recall that from that interview we did with the Sheldrake Wildlife Trust, and when you were there giving the testimony from your time over there, when we all got together. Yeah, and if folks like to listen to that interview with the David Sheldrake Wildlife Trust, you can find it on the archives. So go ahead and check it out. And it is a wonderful organization. You can also go to the Bard's Logic Political Talk website at www.bardslogicpoliticaltalk.com. And you go into the Get Involved page. And there you will see a button that says Save an Elephant on there. Just click on the link. And it will take you to the David Sheldrake Wildlife Trust. And there you can run through on how you can sponsor a baby elephant. And I believe it's only about $50 a year, so it's a great organization to be involved with.
And I also wanted to add that they're doing a campaign right now. And if you go to the website, www.iworry.org, and it is about anti-poaching. And in March, there's going to be a very big meeting with cities, is what it's called. And that's the International Convention for Trade and Endangered Species. And they all come together to vote in favor. Well, Daphne Sheldrake, who started this whole orphanage, is hoping that they will vote in favor of the elephants by banning the sale of all ivory, whether legal or illegal. And previously they had voted to allow the southern African states to sell their so-called legal ivory stockpiles to China and Japan, who colluded to purchase it at a reduced price, and they themselves hiked the price and traded. This has allowed the illegal ivory to be easily laundered into legal stockpiles, and there is proof that as a result, the poaching of elephants throughout Africa escalated sharply. This is what she wrote to me, explaining to me what's going on. So it's really horrific that they're even considering legalizing ivory in certain circumstances, because it's reached such heights that they're reconsidering how they're viewing it. But I did recently found out that the Kenyan government is getting involved, and they're trying to fight against it. So we can only cross our fingers, and you can sign a petition on this iWorry.org against ivory poaching. So I just wanted to put that out there.
Yeah, and thank you very much. And as I said, folks can check that out, and, you know, I think it'd be a great thing to do. And so what we'll do is I believe, one or two questions here as two. Make them sure. Is there anything that you're currently working on or that you have going on or planned for 2013?
Well, right now the focus is on Bones. We are halfway through the season, so I'm very busy with that. And I continue to look forward to doing more work with the Elephant Orphanage. So that's where life is at the moment. So that is 2013 for me.
Okay, great. And then lastly, is just a little bit about your website or other sites and places that the folks in the audience could go to hear more of your work.
Sure. You can go to Julia Newman, www.julianewman.com. And that's N-E-W-M-A-N-N. And also, my husband and I have a joint music website that is actually a compilation of our music. We have a music library that is used in various TV shows and other things. And that's www.newweststudios.com. and you can take listen to some samples there. And you could also visit me on Facebook or on LinkedIn. I'm there. But that's pretty much it. And I hope you get a chance to check it out.
Yeah, definitely. And thank you very much once again for coming on to the show. It's great talking to you and, you know, with email and back and forth and things of that nature. Keep it in touch. And I wish you well and hope things do progress in the future. And I definitely like to invite you back and talk to you again for coming on, and we could get some updates on what you're doing with other shows or with Bones or with the David Children Wildlife Trust.
Well, that sounds wonderful. Thank you again for having me on.
You're welcome. And then as she goes, I will play the music. I thought I was going to start off with tonight, and this was the beginning music that was put together for the show we had with the David Children Wildlife Trust. And here you have it. That was music composed by the woman you just heard earlier. That's Julia Newman, and she put that together for our episode with the David Sheldrick Wildlife Trust. And so there's an example of it, and definitely go check out some more of her works on her websites. Thank you, Joseph, up tonight. And this will be an early edition ending tonight on Bard's Logic. But before we do so, let's talk about, or I'll talk about a few things that are upcoming. Tomorrow night, we will have the national vice chairman of the Constitution Party coming on, and he will be, or we will be discussing pro-life issues as well as what the Constitution Party has been gearing up for the battle for the grassroots. And so we'll be talking about that tomorrow night at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. And then we will also, one thing we're working on doing is having Mark Willis, who is on the looking to have him on the show, and he is challenging Rince Priebus for the chairmanship of the RNC. So we're actually been in contact with the folks for him, and so we're hoping to have him on Monday night is what we're looking for, and that's Mark Willis. As I said, I will keep folks posted up tomorrow night on whether we've get some more details on having him on the show on the 21st. And so I will keep you posted. So once again, I'd like to thank everyone for coming in tonight and listening to the show. And please come in to listen to Randy Stufflebeam tomorrow night and hopefully get an update on the Mark Willis interview we're hoping to have on Monday. So once we get in some more contact with his folks. So I will end tonight the way I end most nights, and that actually every night, and that is by some music. And this time we will hear it from someone we've heard us mention tonight, and that is Aubrey Ashburn. And you can listen to more of her music by going to www.aubreyashburn.com. And thank you very much. I hope to see you all again. Take care and have a good night.